way. For a while I thought we lost you. And then I would have known we were really in trouble. Lotto Satterwhite intentionally missing a party equals Lotto Satterwhite hacking off a leg.
In truth, I just grinned, he said, and bore it.
She turned to him, narrow-eyed. She let her dress fall off her shoulders, pool on the floor. She wore nothing underneath. I just bared it, she said.
Not boring, he said.
Darling, bore me, she said, as in drill.
Like a wild boar, he said. But he was more, to her dismay, like a tired piglet snoozing mid-suckle. And then the swifter downward swoop. All things had lost their savor. He had his casts taken off, but the left side of his body was limp and tender pink, and the texture of an overcooked egg noodle. Mathilde looked at him standing before her naked. She closed one eye.
Demigod, she said.
She closed the other.
Dweeb.
He laughed, but was smacked right in the vanity. He was too weak yet to go home to the city. He longed for pollution, noise, light. The things he'd discovered online had lost their luster. There were only so many cute baby videos one could take, after all, or cats falling off high places. The sun's very shine had been besmirched. And his wife's beauty, which had been so unimpeachable, was irritable, weakened. Such thighs she had, like jamones serranos, salty and overly firm. In morning light, her facial lines had been etched by too strong a hand, her lips thinning, her eye teeth surprisingly long, catching on the rims of mugs, on soup spoons, it made him cringe. And always hovering, blowing on him her breath of impatience. He took to staying in bed past wake-up time, waiting for Mathilde to go off on her run or to her yoga class, off on her bike rides out into the countryside, so that he could go back to sleep. It was almost noon. He held his body still, hearing Mathilde creep in the bedroom door. Then the coverlet lifted, and something soft and furry clambered up his body and licked him, chin to schnoz. He was laughing when he saw the sweet face, like an earmuff with eyeballs and triangular felted ears. "Oh, you," he said to the puppy. And then he looked at Mathilde, and he couldn't help it. There were hot tears in his eyes.
"Thank you," he said. "She's a Shiba Inu," Mathilde said, and crawled to his side. "What's her name?"
"Dog," he wanted to say. He'd always wanted to call a dog, dog. It was meta. It was funny. Oddly, thrillingly, the word came out as God.
God. "Nice to meet you, God," she said.
She picked the puppy up and looked in her face.
"Most sensible epistemology I've ever heard."
There is little that a puppy won't fix, even if the fix is for a short time. For a week, he was practically happy again. Such delight he took in the snarfle of God's hunger, the way she took each piece of kibble out of her bowl to eat off the top of his foot, the pained way she pinched her back legs to her front and flagged her tail, and her little arsehole apertured and bulged, and then she squinted like a philosopher when she eliminated. How she sat quietly with him, chewing on the cuffs of his pants, as he lay on his back and dreamt on a blanket spread in the grass. How he always had something soft under his palm as soon as he called out, "God!" which sounded like the first curse he'd ever said in his life, but was not, as it was a proper noun. How he was rewarded with joy, tiny needle teeth in the meat of his thumb. Even her shrill scream when she was tangled in her leash or kept in her crate for the night made him laugh. He did not fall out of love with the dog, per se. It was merely that luster dulled under the grind of the daily. God could not bridge the distance between his hermit life as a broken man and the life he longs to live again in the city, all interviews and dinners out and being recognized on the subway. She couldn't knit his bones together faster. Her small, quick tongue could not staunch all wounds. Dogs, being wordless, can only be mirrors of their humans. It's not their fault that their people are fatally flawed. Within a week, he felt himself riding the dip again. The thoughts were not serious when he imagined baking a souffle out of the rat poison Mathilde kept in the garden house, or grabbing the wheel out of Mathilde's hands when she let him come with her to the grocery store, veering over this cliffside into that stand of maples. They weren't serious, but they surfaced more and more frequently, until he felt carbonated with dark ideas. He was sinking again. And then it was his birthday, the big 40, and he would rather have slept through the day, but woke to God shuffling off his chest where she slept and clattering down the stairs to Mathilde, who'd been up before dawn trying not to make a sound in the kitchen. Back door opened, closed. Soon enough she was in the room, pulling his nicest summer suit out of the closet. "Shower," Mathilde said. "Put this on. Don't complain. I have a surprise." He did, but it felt bad, waistbands so tight it might have been a girdle. She bundled him into the car, and they set off through the still faint dew, illuminated by dawn. She handed him a hot egg muffin with excellent goat cheese and tomatoes and basil from her garden. "Where's God?" he said. She said, beatifically, with a great swoop of her arms, "All around us." "Hardy har," he said. "Your puppy is with the neighbor's girl and will return to us bathed and coddled and wearing tiny pink bows above her ears. Relax." He settled in, let the landscape pour all over him. This countryside, bled of humans, was entirely right for his mood. He dozed off and awoke to the car parking, a fine, bright morning, a smooth lake, something that seemed like an excessive brown barn in the distance. His wife carried their picnic basket to the edge of the lake under a willow so old it no longer wept, just sort of bore its fate with thickened equanimity. Deviled eggs and champagne, vegetable terrine and Mathilde's own focaccia, manchego cheese and bright red cherries from their orchard, two tiny black-bottom cupcakes, chocolate and cream cheese, his with a candle she lit. He blew it out, hoping for something inexpressible, for something finer, more worthy of him. Someone came around the building ringing a cowbell, and Mathilde packed up slowly. He used his wife as his crutch as they crossed the meadow, all stubble and field mice, to the opera house. It was cool inside, and around them there was a sea of white hairs. "Beware," Mathilde whispered in his ear. "Geriatrism. Contagious, mortal. Don't breathe too deeply." He laughed for the first time, it felt like, in weeks. The long, tender non-chords of the strings tuning. He could listen to such anticipatory non-music for hours and leave this place feeling replenished, he thought. The sides of the opera house began to slide shut against the day. The murmuring hushed, and the conductor came out and raised her arms. She shot them down to an upwelling of what? Not quite music. Sound. Astringent, strange, wild. And yet it slowly resolved itself out of cacophony into a sort of melody. He leaned forward and closed his eyes and felt the mildew that had grown itself over his being these weeks slowly wiped away by the sound. The opera was called Nero. It was a story of Rome burning, but the fire was off stage, and this was not Nero the emperor, but a doppelganger Nero, Nero the keeper of the wine cellars, who could have been the emperor's twin brother, who lived in the palace below the king. It was less a story than a great creature surfacing from the deep. It was more sudden audible wave than narrative. It made Lancelot's head spin. True recognition does this. Dizzies. At intermission, he turned to his wife, and she smiled, as if trying to see him from a very high place. Watchful. Waiting. He whispered, "Oh, I can barely breathe." Out in the courtyard, stunned by sunlight, the soft, cool wind among the poplars. Mathilde fetched them sparkling water. Alone at a cafe table, a woman recognized him. This was happening more and more. He held a general taxonomy of faces in his mind and could usually place people within a second. Not this woman. She laughed, assured him she didn't know him. She had seen the profile in Esquire. "How nice," Mathilde said, when the woman went off to the restrooms. "A little bug zap of fame." Of course, these were his people, theater people. It was to be expected that some of them might have known something about him, but still the woman's star-struck blush had fed something hungry in him. Contrails in the blue sky. Something beginning to break in him. A good breaking, not, this time, bone. In the second act, the story was even more incidental. A tone poem. Dancers emerged with rope to become the fire embodied. By the hot iron gush on his tongue, he understood he'd bit his lip. Curtain. Fa. Mathilde put her cold hands on his face.
"Oh," she said, "you're weeping."
For most of the way home, he kept his eyes closed, not because he didn't want to see his wife or the green, blue, gold of the day, but because he couldn't bear losing the opera. When he opened them, Mathilde's face was drooping. He couldn't remember the last time he saw her without her smile. The light was such he could see the crazing in her skin by her eyes and nose, fine gray hairs and an electric fizz around her head. "Medieval Madonna," he said, "in gouache, haloed in gold leaf. Thank you." "Happy birthday, friend of my heart," she said. "It was happy. It is. That opera changed me."
"I thought it would," she said.
"I'm glad it did. You were getting to be kind of a drag." Spectacular burst of grapefruit as the sun burned itself out. They watched it on their veranda with another bottle of champagne. He picked God up and kissed her on the crown. He wanted to dance, and so he went in and put on Radiohead and swept Mathilde out of her chair with his strong side and pulled her to him. "Let me guess," Mathilde said, her cheek on his shoulder. "Now you want to write an opera." "Yes," he said, breathing her in. "You've never lacked for ambition," she said, and laughed, and it was a sad sound, echoing against the flagstone and the flit of bats above. Now the hours that he would have spent moping, watching voiceover destruction or pinkish naked people working up a sweat, were passed in a frenzy of research. He spent an entire night reading what he could find about the composer. One Leo Sen. Sen, surname South Asian, derived from the Sanskrit for army, bestowed upon those who did an honorable deed. Lived in Nova Scotia. Fairly new artist, having compositions performed for only about 6 years, fairly young. Hard to tell, because there were no images of Leo Sen online, only one CV from 2 years earlier and a smattering of praise for his work. The New York Times listed him as an exciting foreign composer. Opera News had a two-paragraph description of a work titled Paracelsus. There were a few audio clips of a work in progress on someone's amateurish website, but it was from 2004, so long ago as to have possibly been student work. Inasmuch as a person can be a ghost on the internet, Leo Sen had made himself into one. "Genius hermit," Lancelot pictured. Monomaniacal, wild-eyed, made mad by his own brilliance, or no, semi-autistic, burly beard, loincloth, socially incompetent, savage at heart. Lancelot emailed nearly everyone he knew to find out if anybody knew him. Not a soul did. He emailed the festival director up at the opera house in the cow fields to see if she would give him contact information. Distillation of her response? "What's in it for us?" Distillation of his. First pass on a possible collaboration. Distillation of hers. "You have my blessing. Here you go." September? Already? Leaves flaked off the trees. God grew a fluffy underlayer of down. Lancelot still had a hitch in his walk from his weakling leg. His narcissism so vast that it seemed the world itself had gone tentative and wobbly to mimic his body. They'd gone to the city for the week, come home to the country for the weekend. At night, every night, he wrote a short email to Leo Sen. No response yet. Mathilde was wary, watchful. When he finally came to bed, she turned to him in her sleep, clinging, she who never wanted to be touched while she slept. He woke with her hair in his mouth, an arm somehow gone missing until he sat upright and felt the blood coming painfully back. At last, a day in early October, a new chill in the air, he got Leo Sen on the telephone. The voice was not what he was expecting. It was soft and hesitant, British accent, which surprised him at first, and on second thought, well, India had been colonized, the educated class certainly would have fine-grained BBC inflections. Was this racist? He wasn't sure. "You said Lancelot Satterwhite?" Leo Sen said. "This is a thrill." "A thrill for me," Lancelot said too loudly in his discomfort. He had imagined this so often it was strange now to hear the soft voice, to be told, first, that he was admired. He was expecting Leo Sen to be isolated in his genius, to be irritated by contact. Leo Sen explained there was no internet on the island where he lived, and the phone worked only when someone was around to answer it. It was an intentional community, dedicated to humble daily work and contemplation. "Sounds like a monastery," Lancelot said. "Or a nunnery," Leo said. "Feels like it sometimes, too." Lancelot laughed. Oh, Leo had a sense of humor. What a relief. In his gladness, Lancelot found himself describing his reaction to Leo's work at the opera house in the summer, how it rocked something in him. He used the word great. He used the phrases sea change and sui generis. "I'm so glad," Leo Sen said. "I would do almost anything to collaborate on an opera with you," Lancelot said. The silence was so long he almost hung up, defeated. "Well, good effort, Lancelot. It wasn't in the stars. Sometimes things don't work out. Back up on that horse, head down and into the wind. Onward, partner."
"Sure," said Leo Sen. "Yes, of course."
Before they hung up, they agreed on a 3-week residency at an artist colony for them both in November. Lancelot was owed a favor, and he thought he could get them in. The first day or so, Leo had to finish a commission for a string quartet, but they could start thinking, talking things over. Then they would have endless, relentless work for the next 3 weeks until they had some ideas, maybe even a stab at the book.
"What do you think?" said Leo's voice on the line.
"The concept part is actually the most difficult for me." Lancelot looked at the bulletin board in his office, where he'd pinned at least 100 ideas, 1,000 ideas.
"I think the concept part won't be a problem for us," he said.
In the morning, Mathilde went whirring off on an 80-mile bike ride. Lancelot undressed and looked at himself in the mirror. Oh, middle age, how awful. He was used to having to look for his lost beauty in his face, but not in his body that had been so tall and strong all his life. Now, though, the wrinkles in the skin of his scrotum, the swirl of gray in the chest hair, the fetal neck waddle. One chink in the armor, and death seeps in. He turned this way and that until he found the angle that made him look the way he'd been before his impromptu flight down the stairs in the spring. Over his shoulder, he saw God on the bed, watching him, her chin on her paws. He blinked. He gave a brilliant grin at the Lancelot he saw in the mirror, winking and nodding and whistling through his teeth as he put his clothes back on, even brushing imaginary dust off the shoulders of his sweater, picking the pills, making a satisfied grunt before hurrying off, as if remembering an urgent chore. And then it was November, and they were spinning past the thwarted graying fields, over the Hudson, into Vermont, New Hampshire. A hush in the air. A gathering of energy. In his feverish preparations, Lancelot had lost 10 pounds. He'd spent hours on the stationary bicycle, because only movement made him think. Now his knees jerked to some music inaudible to Mathilde, who drove. "I've narrowed the ideas down to 5, M," he said. "Listen to this. Retelling of Maupassant's The Necklace. Or The Little Mermaid, the opposite of Disney. Anderson, but extended to even more extreme weirdness. Or The Trials of Job, but kooky, funny, dark. Or interlocking stories of soldiers in Afghanistan that together tell a kind of longer story, like Chronicle of a Death Foretold, or The Sound and the Fury in opera form." Mathilde bit her bottom lip with her long incisors and looked only at the road. "Kooky?" she said. "Funny, dark? People don't really think opera and funny. You think fat ladies, solemnity. Rhine maidens, women killing themselves for the love of a good man. Opera has a long tradition of humor. Opera buffa. It used to be the primary entertainment for the masses. It'd be nice to democratize it again, make it popular entertainment. Make the mailman sing it on his rounds. He looks as if he's hiding a beautiful voice under that little blue uniform." "Yes," she said, "but you're known for your lyricism. You're serious, Lotto. Exuberant sometimes, but not funny."
"You don't think I'm funny?"
"I think you're hilarious. I think your work isn't really funny, though."
"Not even Gacy?" he said.
"Gacy was dark, wry, humorous in a bleak way. Not funny, per se."
"You think I can't be funny?" he said.
"I think you can be dark, wry, and humorous in a bleak way," she said. "For sure."
"Splendid. I will prove you wrong. Now, what do you think of my ideas?"
She made a face and shrugged.
"Oh," he said. "None of those."
"Lots of retellings," she said.
"I mean, not the Afghanistan one."
"No," Mathilde said. "True. That's the only great idea. Maybe too on the nose, though. Too obvious. Make it more allegorical."
"Brank your tongue, witchy wife," he said. Mathilde laughed.
"Maybe this is something that both of you will have to agree on anyway. You and this Leo Sen of yours."
"Leo. I feel like a teenager all dressed up in cummerbund and bow tie, heading off to the winter dance," he said.
"Well, my love, this is how people sometimes feel when they meet you," Mathilde said, gently. Gently. His cabin was small, stone, with a fireplace, not so far from the main house where dinner and breakfast would be, and he worried for the first time about ice, about falling with his still flimsy leg. There was a desk, a chair, and a bed that was normal size, which meant his legs would hang off up to the shins. Mathilde sat at the edge of it and bounced. The frame squeaked like a mouse. Lancelot sat next to her and bounced to her offbeat. He put his hand on her leg and moved it, bounce by bounce, up her thigh until his finger was pushing against her groin, and then he hooked it under her elastic and found an anticipatory lushness there. She stood, and he stopped bouncing, and without pulling the curtains, she pushed the crotch of her panties to the side and straddled him. He put his head up her shirt, loving the companionable darkness there.
"Hello, Private," she said, teasing the tip of him. "A 10 hut?
3 weeks, he said, as she escorted him in. She moved her hips like a cowgirl. He said, "Long time without release."
"Not for me. I bought a vibrator," she said breathlessly. "I named him Lance a Little."
But this wasn't the right thing to say, perhaps, because he felt pressured and had to turn her around on her hands and knees to complete things, and the punctuation was a pallid little orgasm that left him discontented. She called from the bathroom, where she was soaping herself with sink water.
"I'm feeling queasy about leaving you here.
Last time I let you go away from me for a little while, you came back broken.
She returned to him, pressed his cheeks in her hands.
My eccentric old man, thinking you could fly.
This time only my words will fly, he said solemnly. They both cracked up. Almost 20 years together, and if blazing heat had turned to warmth, humor, it was less wild, but easier to sustain. She said tentatively,
There will be brilliant women here, Lotto. And I know how much you love women. Or did. Once. I mean, before me.
He frowned. Never in their lives together had she been jealous. It was undignified of her. Of him. Of their marriage. He withdrew a little.
Oh, please, he said.
And she shook it off and kissed him deeply and said,
If you need me, I'll come. I'm 4 hours away, but I'll be here in 3.
And then she went out the door. She was gone. Alone. The twilit forest watched him through the windows. He did push-ups out of exuberance because it wasn't yet dinner time. He unpacked his notebooks, his pens. He went out to the circular drive around his cottage and pulled a fern out by the roots and planted it in a white speckled navy mug and put it on the mantel, even though it was already curling at the corners with the unexpected indoor heat. When the dinner bell rang, he limped up the dusky dirt road past the meadow with its statue of a deer. Or no, a real and rather springy deer. Past the hayrick turned to chicken house in the raspberry canes, past the garden replete with pumpkins glowing in the dim, the overgrown stalks of Brussels sprouts, to the old farmhouse from which delicious food smells were emanating. The 2 tables were already filled, and he stood in the French doors until someone waved him over, touching an empty seat. He sat, and the whole table turned, blinking, as if a sudden bright light had clicked on. These people were so beautiful. He didn't know why he had been nervous. This frizzled and famous poet, who was showing everybody the perfect cicada husk on her palm. This German couple who could be twins, with their identical rimless eyeglasses and hair as if it had been cropped with a sling blade in their sleep. This ginger-headed boy barely out of college, with the sudden pink wash of debilitating shyness. Poet, clearly. This novelist, blonde, athletic, not bad despite the breeder's gut and purple bags under her eyes. Nowhere near Mathilde, but young enough to be the kind of person who might give Mathilde pause. She did have lovely white forearms, as if cut from polished spruce wood. Once upon a time, when every woman dazzled with particular beauty, her forearms would have been plenty for him, and young Lotto returned for a moment, sexy hound dog, in sucking orgy, the novelist's round belly with the silvery stretch marks on it. Lovely. He passed her the pitcher of water, and shook the image away. A very young African-American filmmaker studied Lancelot, said,
Satterwhite? I just graduated from Vassar. There was a Satterwhite Hall there.
And Lancelot winced a little, sighed. It had been an unpleasant shock when, this past spring, he'd visited his alma mater for a lecture, and the dean had stood and, among other encomiums in his introduction, mentioned that Lancelot's family had donated the dormitory to the school. Lotto did the math and remembered finding Sally, graduation weekend, standing before a vast pit in the ground where bulldozers were moving, her face set and skirt blowing against her skinny legs. She'd hooked her arm through his and led him away. It was true he'd applied to only 1 school, and that the acceptance letter had apparently been mailed home to Florida. He'd never seen it. If there was perfidy, it had the stamp of Antoinette all over it. Oh, he said to the filmmaker, who was looking at him strangely. Lancelot's face must have betrayed him. No relation. Lights came on over the porch outside, a raccoon triggering the sensor. When they went off, the sky was doubled navy velvet. They passed the whole shining salmon in its bed of kale and lemons, the bowl of quinoa salad. Lancelot found he could not stop talking. He was simply thrilled to be here. Someone had poured him wine after wine. Some artists had disappeared by dessert, but most had pulled their chairs over to his table. He told the story of his failed flight down the plane's staircase. He told the story of the disastrous audition when he was an actor, when he was asked to strip to the waist, and had forgotten that Mathilde had that morning in the shower shaved a smiley face into his chest hair.
"I had heard you were a character," the poet said, over the creme brulee, laying her hand on his arm. She had laughed so hard that her eyes were dewy. "I had no idea what a character."
At the other table, there had been a vaguely Indianish woman in a tunic, and Lancelot felt a flutter in his gut. Could Leo be short for Leona? There were women with male voices. She had a white streak in her black hair that seemed appropriately eccentric for the maker of that opera he had seen this summer. She had gorgeous hands, like owlets. But she stood abruptly, carried her plate and utensils to the kitchen, and left, and he swallowed a bitter mouthful. She hadn't wanted to meet him. Now they were in the main room, with its pool and ping-pong tables, and he was playing. Even with the alcohol, his reactions were swift. He was still a bit of an athlete, he was pleased to see, even after his summer encased in plaster. Someone brought out the whiskey. When he stopped, panting, his noodled left arm a little pangy, a tiny circlet of artists formed around him. Lancelot fell into his automatic charm.
"What's your name? What do you do?" he asked them, one by one.
Artists. Narcissists. Some better than others at concealing, but like children standing at the edge of the playground, fingers in mouths, watching the others wide-eyed as they were one by one induced to play. Each, when invited to talk, was secretly relieved that someone saw them as important as they were, that the most important person in the room had recognized them as equally the most important in the room, if only potentially so, if only in the future. Because, Lancelot knew, beaming so kindly upon all the others, that he was the only real artist at the place. When it was his turn, the bright, blushing, red-headed boy said his name so softly that Lancelot had to lean forward and ask him to say it again, and the boy looked at him with a flash of something, stubbornness, amusement, and said, "Leo." Lancelot moved his mouth until words at last came out.
"You're Leo? Leo Sen? Leo Sen the composer?"
"In the flesh," said Leo. "Glad to meet you." And when Lancelot still couldn't speak, the ginger boy said dryly, "Expecting an Indian, weren't we? I get that often. My father's half Indian and looks it. His genes were steamrolled by my mother's. On the other hand, my sister looks like she should be in a Bollywood film, and nobody can believe we are related one iota."
"All this time, and you were just standing there?" Lancelot said. "Letting me make a fool of myself?"
Leo shrugged and said, "I was amused. I wanted to see what my librettist was like as a person."
"But, excuse me, you can't be a composer. You're in kindergarten," Lancelot said.
26, Leo said. "Hardly in nappies." For such a blusher, there was an edge to his words.
"You are nothing like what I expected," Lancelot said.
Leo blinked hard. His hue had deepened to angry lobster.
"And that, I think, is a marvelous thing. Who wants what's expected?"
"Not I," said Lancelot.
"Nor I," said Leo.
He regarded Lancelot for a caesura and finally relaxed into an off-kilter smile. He had hands that could palm a basketball, Leo Sen, though his frame was a slight and stooping 6 feet. This was their first intoxicating talk on the couch. Everyone else faded back to ping-pong or pool or home over the dark ground to work some more, dim headlamps to light their paths. The opera this past summer came out of his struggles with a foundering kind of sadness, the feeling of panic as the outside world came roaring in.
"I work my way out of it, usually," Leo said. "I fight my music until we're both too exhausted to feel much of anything."
"I know exactly what you mean,"
It's like Jacob wrestling with God, Lancelot said. Or Jesus with the devil.
I'm an atheist, but they sound like nice myths, Leo said, and laughed. He said his house on the Nova Scotia commune island was made of hay bales and mud, and that his job there was to teach music to anyone who wanted to learn. He owned few things, 10 white button-down shirts, 3 pairs of jeans, socks, underwear, pair of boots, pair of moccasins, a jacket, musical instruments, and that was about it. Stuff had never interested him, beyond the music he could make from it. Books were necessary, but borrowed. His only extravagance was soccer, though he called it football, of course, rooted for Tottenham. His mother, you see, was Jewish. She loved how Tottenham fought back against anti-Semitic slurs and called themselves the Yid Army. The Yiddos. For Leo, he said, it had also been the name. So meaty. So metrical. Tottenham Hotspur. Its own tiny song. In the common house on the island, there was a television, satellite dish like a cocked ear on the roof, mostly for emergencies. But they made an exception for Leo Sen's passionate love of the game. I hated my violin as a boy, he said, until my father made me compose a score as a match was happening on the telly. Tottenham, Manchester, our boys losing. And suddenly, as I was playing, everything that I had felt so deeply without music deepened even more. The dread, the joy. And that was it for me. Recreating that moment was all I wanted to do. I called the composition Audere Est Facere. He laughed.
To dare is to do, Lotto said.
Tottenham's motto. Not a bad way to be an artist, in fact.
Your life seems simple, Lancelot said. Leo Sen said, My life is beautiful.
Lancelot saw that it was. He was enough of a lover of forms to understand the allure of such a strict life, how much internal wildness it could release. Leo waking to dawn over the cold seabird ocean, the fresh berries and goat milk yogurt for breakfast, the tisanes of his own herbs, blue crabs in the black tide pools, going to bed with the whipping winds and rhythm of waves against hard rock, lettuce shoots glowing in the south-facing windows. The celibacy, the temperate, moderate life that Leo lived, at least on the outside, in his state of constant cold, and the feverish musical life within.
I knew you'd be an ascetic, Lancelot said. I just thought you'd be a wild bearded one who speared fish and wore a loincloth. In a saffron-colored turban, he smiled.
On the other hand, you, Leo said, were always dissolute. It's clear in your work. Privilege is what lets you take risks. Life of oysters and champagne and houses on the beach. Coddled. Like the precious egg you are.
Lancelot felt stung, but said, True. If I had my druthers, I'd be 350 pounds of jollity and fun. But my wife keeps me to heel. Makes me exercise every day. Keeps me from drinking in the morning.
Ah, said Leo, gazing at his own enormous hands. So there's a wife.
The way he said it, well, it made the ideas Lancelot had about Leo reshuffle themselves once more in his head.
There's a wife, Lancelot said. Mathilde. She's a saint. One of the purest people I've ever met. Just morally upright, never lies, can't bear a fool. I've never met someone who stayed a virgin until just before she got married, but Mathilde was. She thinks it's unfair that other people clean up your dirt, so she cleans our house even though we can afford a housekeeper. She does it all, everything. And everything I write for her first.
The grand love story, then, Leo said lightly.
But it's exhausting to live with a saint.
Lancelot thought of his tall wife with her blaze of white blonde hair.
It is, he said.
And then Leo said,
Oof, look at the time. I need to go to work. Nocturnal beastie, I'm afraid. Shall I see you in the afternoon?
And Lancelot saw they were alone, most lights turned out,
and it was 3 hours past any bedtime he usually had. Also, he was drunk. He couldn't locate the words that would tell Leo how profoundly familiar he had found him. He wanted to say how he, too, had had a good dad who understood him, and he, too, longed for a simple, clean life, and how he, too, found his fullest joy in the midst of work. But Leo's studio was across the field and through the forest, and when they came out of the main house, the boy said goodbye quickly, invisible, though his breath plumed white into the darkness. Lancelot, on his own slow shuffle through the pitch black, had to be satisfied with the thought of tomorrow. The revelations falling off in layers, like the separate skins of an onion. He would find a true friend all the way on the inside. He fell asleep watching the lick of flames in his fireplace, a long, slow submergence and smoky contentment that led into a sleep the depth of which he could not remember having had for years. Hot milk of a world, with its skin of morning fog in the window. Lunch on the porch, in a plated basket, vegetable soup and focaccia and good cheddar and celery and carrot sticks and an apple and cookie. Glorious blue-gray day, and he couldn't stay inside. He wanted to be working. In late afternoon, he pulled on his boots and his barber jacket and went out for a walk in the woods. The chill on his face turned itself inside out, and he grew warm. Heat begat lustiness, and lustiness carried him to a moss-covered rock, a deep cold beneath the warm, green, velvety nap. With his pants to his knees, engaged in heavy self-fondle. Thoughts of Mathilde had become amagnetic, rebounding off her, spinning outward, ending up hopelessly tangled in thoughts of an Asian nymphette cooing at him in a schoolgirl's kilt, as fantasies tended to. Tree branches, gray slats above, and moving polka dots of crows. Frantic motions in the groinal area until the inevitable upward spin and the slick in the palm. The lake at his heels so still, poxed by the touch of scattered rain. By the time he stood, anxiety was thickening in his chest. He hated putting off work when he was in the mood. It was as if the muses were singing, rather humming, and he'd stuffed up his ears. He walked in the general direction of Leo's cabin, the silence of the woods so eerie the ancient poems of his babyhood returned to him. He sang them to himself as if they were songs. When he arrived at Leo's, pinkish stucco, pseudo-Tudor, flanked with ferns that gleamed in the dim gray light, he understood that he'd been hoping he'd find his collaborator noodling around on his porch. But there was no movement anywhere, and inside, the curtains were unstirred. Lancelot sat behind a birch tree, wondering what to do. When it grew dark enough, he crept near and looked in the window. No lights had been turned on, but the curtains had been opened, and someone was moving in the room. It was Leo, and he was standing, his skinny white chest bare, and he had his eyes closed, his freckled face young, almost teenaged looking, and his hair in little sandy tufts all over his head. He was waggling his arms. Once in a while, he would move over to the sheet set on the piano and make notations and hurry back to where he had been, closing his eyes again. His bare feet were as enormous as his hands, and, like the hands, red at the knuckles with cold. How strange it felt to Lancelot to see someone else being lifted on a creative crest. He thought of the hours and hours he'd spent carried along, and how utterly silly he might have looked had anyone at all peeped in and seen him. First in the windowless closet they'd converted to his study in the city, and then in the country house in his glossy attic study, with the Shakespearean compendium on its prayer stand, and the gardens in the window, Mathilde moving among them. For many months up there, he had looked down and considered how the lifespan of a sunflower reflected the lifespan of man. Hopeful, beautiful, brightly shooting out of the ground, broad and strong, with a face turned full and dutiful toward the sun, head so heavy with ripe thoughts it bowed toward the ground, turned brown, lost its bright hair, grew weak on its stalk, mowed down for the long winter. He'd spoken in voices, strutted, cringed, marched, minced up there. 11 major plays, 2 additional probably not so major in retrospect, an
and he performed all of them as he wrote them, to blank walls. Then the audience of sunflowers and Mathilde's slim back, bending toward the weeds below. He came to when he saw Leo buttoning up one of his shirts, putting on his sweater, then his jacket, sliding moccasins over his feet. He walked around to the road and headed toward the boy's front door, calling out to him as Leo came out and fiddled with the lock.
"Oh, hello," Leo said. "Have you come to find me? I'm so glad. I'm feeling rather guilty about you. I had planned to wrap up early and talk over our project, but the composition I was working on rudely insisted that I stick with it to the bitter end. We're off to supper, then? We can talk as we walk, perhaps."
"Let's go," Lancelot said. "I have a million ideas. I'm boiling over with them. I had to go for a walk to get away from them, but the problem with ideas is that the more you walk, the more you get. They breed in the brain pan."
"Brilliant," Leo said. "Glad to hear it. Go ahead and spin."
By the time they sat at supper, Lancelot had gone over his top five. Leo was frowning, pink from the cold. He passed the roasted vegetable tort, then said,
"No, none of those, I think. I wait for the spark, you see, and those ideas don't have the spark, I'm afraid."
"All right," said Lancelot, and he was about to launch into the next five when he felt a hand on his shoulder and a voice hot in his ear saying,
"Lotto!"
And he looked up, at first uncomprehendingly, at Natalie. Natalie! Of all people! Natalie of the potato nose over the thin black mustache. She had done well in the internet boom, but apparently had cashed out her stock and was so rich she could return to what she loved most, which was, how very unexpected, sculpture, of all things. She was white with plaster dust and heavier. Well, they all were heavier. Fine etchings around her eyes, which were still so strangely resentful. There was lots of hugging, lots of celebration, Natalie sitting beside Lancelot and filling him in on life. But when Lancelot turned to introduce Natalie to Leo, Leo had already bussed his plate and utensils and had vanished, leaving an apologetic note in Lancelot's mailbox. He was under pressure to get this commission done, could concentrate fully on the opera when he was finished. "So very, very sorry." His handwriting as tiny and precise as typescript. And then the endless apologies. 4 days in a row.
I know, it's terrible, Lancelot. I'm so horribly sorry, but I really must get this commission done. It's killing me, in fact."
Leo's face flaming as soon as he saw Lancelot, a new nervousness born out of shame. Whenever Lancelot staked him out, watching in the woods through the windows, the boy was working, feverish and writing, and because he wasn't faffing about or napping or scratching himself like a sloth, Lancelot couldn't resent him, which only made the wait more difficult. Down in the cubby in the basement laundry room of the colony house where he had to telephone Mathilde, no cell service here, they were truly removed from the world, he vented his frustration in a whisper. She made cooing sounds, husky noises of support. But it was 5 in the morning. She wasn't at her best.
"How about some telephonic kink?" she said at last. "A little sultry-sultry across the wires? Calm you down a bit?"
"No, thank you," he said. "I'm too distressed." A long, long pause, her breath at the other end.
"This is bad, isn't it?" she said. "This new crisis. I've never known you to pass up a little phone sex."
She sounded sad. He missed her, his wife. It felt strange to wake up without needing to bring her milky coffee every morning. He felt the lack of the tiny cares she took for him, the way she laundered his clothes, the way she trimmed his eyebrows. Part of him, here, was lacking.
"I want to be home with you," he said. "Me too, my love. So come home," she said.
"I'll give it a few more days," he said. Then the booty call in the dark of the night.
"I'll be beside the phone," she said, breathlessly waiting. "I'll keep the keys in the ignition."
After dinner that night, he went with a clump of artists through the woods, flashlights spearing the black,
to the German sculptor's studio, a three-story building with a removable side and a hydraulic lift for the heaviest art. There was vodka chilled in the stream in back, and a sort of seething music, all electric spikes. The lights had been turned off. In the front room, a two-story flutter, love notes from the German Frau's first marriage barely tethered to a structure so it shifted in the wind, one tiny home movie projected on each. A sculpture of marriage. Marriage come alive. Lancelot felt tears start to his eyes. It was so exactly right. The Germans saw the gleam, and both of them, like budgerigars on their perch, sidled up and hugged Lancelot around the waist. On the fifth day of artistic stymie, Lancelot woke to a miserable, drizzly dawn and took a bike and coasted down the hill to the town gym's pool. The water made everything better. He was not a good swimmer, but the thrashing helped, and he spent longer and longer with each lap just gliding underwater. It washed over him, calmed him, brought him back to where he had been in the car, coming to the residency. Perhaps it was the oxygen depletion. Perhaps his rangy body had finally gotten the exercise it needed, especially in light of his enforced celibacy. Perhaps only he had exhausted himself to the point where his anxieties had fallen away. False. He should have known a gift when he saw one. But when he came to the end of the pool, touched the wall, pulled himself up, he knew what the opera would be. It rose before him, gleaming, more real than the water it overlay. He sat so long at the end of the pool, having forgotten himself, that his skin was dry when he looked up to see Leo standing beside him, still in his jeans and white button-down and moccasins. "They told me you were down here splashing about. I've come to fetch you in a little car I've borrowed. So sorry to keep you waiting for so very, very long, but you know it means that we're both keen to begin. If it is convenient for you, I'm ready," Leo said. He moved, and at last his face, which had been silhouetted by the sun coming directly through the window, was visible. "Antigone," Lancelot said, and smiled up at him. "Sorry?" Leo said. "Antigone," Lancelot said. "Spark." "Antigone?" Leo said. "Antigone, underground. Our opera. Antigone, who hadn't hanged herself, or she had tried, but before she succeeded, the gods had cursed her with immortality. First they gave it as a gift, for hewing to their laws against those of men. And then, when she railed against the gods, it turned into a taunt. She's in her cave still, even today. I was thinking of the Cumaean Sibyl, who lived for 1,000 years, so long that she shrank and was put in an urn. Eliot quoted it as an epigraph for the wasteland, from Petronius Arbiter's Satyricon. For once I saw with my own eyes the Cumaean Sibyl hanging in a jar. When the boys asked her, 'Sibyl, what do you want?' she said, 'I want to die.'" Long silence, pool lapping at the gutters. A woman hummed to herself as she did a slow, frog-like kick on her back. "Oh my God," Leo said. "Yeah," Lancelot said. Also, Antigone in the original was on the side of the gods and against men, as in the order of men, as in Creon's dictates against her brothers being honored by burial. But I think we can extend this to a sense of misandry. No, not misandry, but perhaps misanthropy. She scorns the gods for leaving her, humans for their flaws. She has shrunk so small she is beneath humans, literally beneath their feet, and yet she's above them. Time has purified her. She has become the spirit of humanity. We should change the title. What about Antigone? Play with the fact that she's still here? No? He had led Leo into the locker room and was toweling himself off exuberantly. He took off his trunks. When he looked up, Leo's eyes were enormous, and he was sitting on his bench, his hands folded in his lap, as he watched naked Lancelot. He was pinkish in the face. "Antigonist," Leo said, looking down. "Wait. The Antigonad," Lancelot said,
First as a joke, because, well, he was just then pulling up his boxer briefs. All right, it was true. He had lingered a little in the buff. There had been an internal hot flash of vanity and gratitude for being looked at. It had been so long since a stranger had seen him naked. Well, there had been that run of Equus in the mid-90s, but it had played for only 12 nights and the theater had only 200 seats. But when he said the joke, he found he liked it. "The Antigonad," he said again. "Maybe it's a love story. A love story and she's stuck in a cave. The lovers can't touch." "For now," said Leo. "We can always change if we find ourselves to be pro-gonad, I suppose." Was that suggestive? It was hard to tell with this boy.
"Leo, Leo," Lancelot said. "You are as dry as vermouth."
And then came the prolix period, when they did not stop talking. For 4 days, now five, now seven, without really writing anything yet. They worked in strange twilight limbo. Lancelot always an early riser, Leo up all night, sleeping until 2 in the afternoon. They compromised by meeting at Lancelot's when Leo was awake. They worked until Lancelot fell asleep, full clothed, waking briefly only when the door blasted cold into the cabin as Leo left. Lancelot read the original Sophocles play aloud, while Leo lay on his hearth before the cheery fire and dreamt, listening. And then, for context, Lancelot read aloud the other two parts of the Triumvirate, Oedipus Rex and Oedipus at Colonus. He read aloud the fragments of Euripides. He read the Seamus Heaney adaptation aloud. They read Anne Carson, their heads together. They listened in silence to the Orff opera, the Honegger Cocteau opera, the Theodorakis opera, the Trietta opera. At supper they sat engaged, tight and thick, and they spoke of their Antigone, whom they called Go, as if she were a friend. Leo hadn't yet written any music, but he had made drawings on butcher paper stolen from the kitchen. They curled around his walls, intricate doodles, extensions of the boy's own lean, slight body. The shape of Leo's jaw in profile, devastating. The way he gnawed his fingernails to the crescents, the fine, shining hairs down the center of his nape. The smell of him, up close, pure and clean, bleachy. The ones made for music are the most beloved of all. Their bodies are a container for the spirit within. The best of them is music, the rest only instrument of flesh and bone. The weather conspired. Snow fell softly in the windows. It was too cold to be out for long. The world colorless, a dreamscape, a blank page. The linger of wood smoke on the back of the tongue. The collaborators were in so deep that when Natalie tried to sit with them for dinner, Lancelot barely smiled at her before turning back to sketch out what he was saying to Leo on a piece of scrap paper. And Natalie sat back in her chair, tearing up. Their friendship mostly in the past, but, oh, he still had the power to hurt her with his disregard. Until she smiled it away. She watched Lotto. She was listening. There was an electricity here. Both men were flushed, shoulders close. If Lotto had been paying attention to Natalie, he would have understood that there would be talk later, the old friend network sparked by what she'd say she'd seen between the two men. At last she nodded and bussed her tray and left. And as this was her last night at the residency, he wouldn't see her again. Her death would be soon and sudden. Ski tumble, embolism. The German sculptors had returned to Nuremberg without Lancelot's noticing it, and a pale young woman had taken their place. She painted one-story tall oils of the shadows of objects, not the objects themselves. The blonde novelist went home to her house full of boys. The colony contracted in winter. Now there was only one table of artists at dinner. The frizzled poet wore a face of disappointment when she came in night after night to see the collaborators together.
"Lancelot, my dear. Won't you talk any more to anyone but that boy?"
she said once, leaning close, when Leo went in to fetch the dessert tray for the group. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'll come back to you soon, Emmy Lynn. It's just the initial stages, the head-over-heels phase." She rested her papery cheek on his upper arm and said,
I understand. But, Dovey, it is not healthy to be so immersed for so long. You need to come up for air.
And then there was the note in the office from his wife, her